brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Okay, welcome to Soft Rap Radio, where it's Big Phil Campion's turn to do some talking to you again. And don't forget, on time, on target with Soft Rap Radio. So it's a pleasure to be here again. It's been a good week for me. Started off the week this Sunday with Remembrance Day, very poignant day. Now, Remembrance Day is our day. This is the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And it's when we observe a 2 minute silence for our fallen since First World War. Okay, so the First World War, the Second World War, and campaigns since. It's also customary for us over here to wear a red poppy. Now, you will see white poppies and the like sprouting up from various organisations who don't really want to go with the flow. It's not something I endorse. A red poppy is, as far as I'm concerned, what we wear to show our respect for the people who afforded us the liberty that we now have today to cut around and do our bits and pieces. So it's just showing a mark of respect to our fallen. And like I say, it's our Armistice Day or Remembrance Day. So I went to Gibraltar this year, which is somewhere, I'm actually in Spain right now as we speak. But I went over to Gibraltar. Obviously, Gibraltar is at the tip of Spain, right down the south as far as you can get. And it's a rock and it's owned by the English. Well, owned by the British. And there's a remembrance service there, which has a great turnout. The governor of the island, they actually have their own regiment, the Gibraltar Regiment, which is quite interesting. So over the next few months, I'll probably go back to Spain and maybe do a few bits and pieces with the Gibraltar Regiment, because they're a cracking load of guys. They get some good work. My son's just recently, with his regiment, been working with them in Morocco, which has been really cool. So yeah, the Gibraltar Regiment. So this year, my Remembrance Sunday was spent in Gibraltar. Other towns that have great big parades, obviously London at the Cenotaph, the main war memorial to our glorious dead, is attended by thousands, absolutely, probably hundreds of thousands of people will come into London and take part in the parade there. Outside of London, you've got all the big cities, all the major cities, Southampton, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, all these big towns will have a Remembrance Day parade of some sort. And then you go out into the smaller areas of the UK, and you got to remember, during the World Wars, the UK is not a massive country. So the chances of any small village or hamlet or town not being affected by war was very, very, very unlikely. And so as you drive through the countryside, just about every village, every hamlet, every possible place has got its own memorial to people that lived in that area and were taken from us early for sacrificing, making the ultimate sacrifice of going to war for your country. So it's a very poignant time for me, and I think it's important that the youth of today understand why we do this. You know, we're not glorifying war. That's not the idea. It's not, you know, it's not to say how great wars are, because wars aren't great. However, you know, a country is entitled to defend itself, and oppressors need to be dealt with. And, you know, it's a well-known fact that if we hadn't dealt with things in the First World War, the Second World War, the outcome would have been very, very different to what it is today. We could even be living under a dictatorship. And then how much liberty would you be afforded to run around town shouting, gobbing off and doing all the rest of the stuff that you do on a daily basis? So, you know, for the youth of today, it's very, very important to me that they learn. It's part of our history, part of our culture. And don't forget, you know, we are British. We live on an island several times over the place's history. People have tried to invade that island. And, you know, there's always been a plan in place for us to defend our island to the last man, if need be. That's the way it is. So, you know, when I see people berating people for celebrating or remembering our fallen. It does make me a little bit sad to see that sort of stuff. So that was Remembrance Sunday this week, last Sunday, 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month, every year without fail. And I should be turning out. And like I say to a lot of people, I remember our fallen every day of the year. It's not just on the 11th, okay? So, you know, some people, it affects their lives more than others. And certainly, you know, I've lost my fair share of friends, as have, you know, a good deal of you great folk out there as well. So, yeah, that's enough said on that. I'm not gonna go great into depth on that, but I just thought I'd mention it. We'll chat a little bit of politics tonight. Obviously, we've got a general election coming up over here, which is going to throw up some interesting stuff. We have two main parties over here, if you didn't understand how it goes. We're the Labour Party, and we have the Conservative Party. The Conservatives are in power at the moment. And the Labour Party, you'd probably say, are more liberal types. The Conservative are more of your armed forces, you know, and that sort of stuff. I would have said the current leader of the Labour Party isn't popular with a lot of people on both sides of the coin because he has links, you know, proven links to organisations which you probably wouldn't want to associate yourself with. Doesn't get too good a press. But it'll be interesting because they're all making promises around our armed forces at the moment and around our veterans. But we get this every time. Promises, 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 promises. And very, very, very little deliverance when it comes to actually push comes to a shove. These people get in power and they don't ever seem to deliver what they've promised. But the next coming months and this general election could have quite a bearing on how things go. And don't forget, we've been kicking this Brexit can down the road for a very long time. You know, me personally, I'm a Brexiteer. I do want to leave the European Union. And it's about time we cut our ties. But a lot of people don't see it my way, and obviously have dragged their heels, and we still haven't managed to deliver what we voted for over 3 years ago now. So politically in the UK, a very turbulent time, as is the rest of the world, really, having turbulent times with their politics and the way it is. Let's park politics there for today. So what am I up to this week? I'm off to Bulgaria, where I should be running some shooting courses. Which I'm looking forward to. I've also been doing some filming, which I can't let you know about right now, but I've been doing some really interesting stuff. We've had the Remembrance Rumble now, as some of you would have seen, which was my big boxing match. So I'm winding down now a little bit to Christmas, so it'll be interesting. I'm doing my live shows on Sofrep on Facebook. Got some really cool stuff coming up in Bulgaria. I'm probably taking a trip out to Canada, although I don't know how you lot feel about the Canadians in America. I should be having a cool time out there for sure. And then I've got some stuff in the UK. So plenty going on, plenty to look forward to, and plenty of stuff that I'll be doing in the coming weeks. So what was I going to talk about tonight? I thought I'd give you a bit of my history tonight and talk to you about my experiences in Northern Ireland or the province, because as a young soldier, that was the first place I ever saw combat, and that was the first place I went. And it's not always sort of like widely publicised outside of the UK. The tribulations and what we went through in Northern Ireland, it was a very, very tricky place to operate. Firstly, give you a little bit of a ground into what happened over there. Massive tension between Catholic estates and Protestant estates. Great divides in employment, social housing and all that sort of stuff, with the Catholic estates probably bearing the brunt of the worst of the housing and the conditions and all that sort of stuff. That said, as tensions rose in the early days, the British Army were taken over there basically to act as a barrier between the two factions, as it were, which were the Protestants and the Catholics. You know, they just basically formed a barrier so that one side couldn't get after the other. Because if you go right back in history, you know, there's been trouble in Ireland for years and years and years. It goes back to the potato famine. You could apportion blame all the way back for hundreds of years. I'm not going to go back that far today. What we're going to deal with is why we originally went there, and it was because tensions were rising between Catholic estates and Protestant estates. And the British Army were first deployed over there in the early 70s to basically provide a barrier between the two. And we're actually probably more concerned with looking after the Catholics than what they were the Protestants. And we went through this period called the honeymoon period, where for a while the British were first there, they were received very well with the Catholic people. You know, to the point that they you see photographs of, you know, women giving them cups of tea and all that sort of stuff and looking after them on cordons while they're parked up on the street doing vehicle checkpoints and all that sort of stuff. But within a very short period of time, the honeymoon period sort of like dissolved and the troops didn't go and the violence intensified And I've guessed that the British were seen more of an occupier now by the people on the Catholic estates, who the majority wanted to remain Irish. That is the crux of it. They wanted to remain as Irish. The Protestants wanted to stay as Britain. Okay, so if you look at the island as a whole, Northern Ireland, the seven counties up at the top, are British. And that's the way the land's been divided for quite some time. Now, in the truth of it, if you really look at it, you know, Ireland went bust a few years ago. If we'd have given back the seven counties, they'd have gone bust a lot quicker than that. So I think, although there's a lot of people saying, oh, we want them back, we want them back, actually, I probably think there's quite a few who didn't. That said, like I say, you know, we were then, as British soldiers, seen as occupiers by the Irish, or those who wanted to be Irish. However, we were now seen as saviours by those who wanted to be British. So it almost flipped on its head. So now we were being attacked by people like the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, the Provisional IRA, INLA, and all these splinter groups came to fruition. Early 70s, lots of violence, 80s. And I got out there for my first trip in about 80, probably 88, I think, or 89, that I did my first trip, 1989, 88. It was a two-year, what they call, residential tour of Northern Ireland in a place called Londonderry, or as the locals will call it, Derry. And I'm not going to go down that argument now because we could talk about that all night on its own. We did what was called a residential tour, which was where you basically took your family and you lived in Northern Ireland if you were married, or if you were a single soldier. You got enough downtime where you could go to places like Portrush and that and have some downtime and some time off. However, that said, it was extremely intense work when you were working, and we did what were called city tours, where we went into small patrol bases in the city of Londonderry and were under constant threat of attack from various different threats, whether it be shooting, bombing. They had all sorts of methods of getting at us in those days, bombing probably being the preferred, but, you know, it wasn't unheard of for them to shoot at you or try and drop something off a building on you, or lots of public unrest, lots of violence, lots of that sort of stuff. You know, to that end, if you were travelling in vehicles, they needed to be armoured, all that sort of stuff. So we did these city tours. They would go on for about 6 or 7 weeks. My first experience with the Irish Republican Army as a contact with the enemy was late in 89, I think, probably coming up to Christmas time. And they put a small bomb outside of one of the patrol bases, which was detonated. Boom, up it went. And we came out to see what it was and react to it. And we found that it hadn't really targeted anything, which told us straight away that it was probably what we call a come-on, which meant that we were going to come out and then get attacked again by another means. So we had to set up an incident control point and all this sort of stuff, because we had rules and regulations and yellow cards and all that sort of stuff. It was difficult. You had to appease so many people when you were working over there. You know, you were working under the constraints of what they call military and aid of the civil powers, okay? It was a difficult time. It was an emergency situation. And like I say, you had to do things properly. So the IRA knew this. And as we came out on this particular time, they had placed another bomb in a pub which was right by our patrol base. So as we got ready in the patrol base, sure enough, boom, up went the second one. And I was stood right next to it when it went. Luckily enough, I was stood behind an armoured vehicle, and most of the blast went over the top of the vehicle because they'd put the bomb in the second floor of this pub, and it blew the rubble up instead of out. And if it had been on the bottom floor of the pub, then I probably wouldn't be telling this story here today without a doubt. So boom, off it went. And it made me ears ring. It was the first time I'd ever been blown up. It sucked the wind out of my chest. Another lad, no one was killed on this one, but one lad broke his leg quite badly, and another one cracked a few ribs as he was blown across the street. And I just remember all this rubble coming down for ages, and you couldn't see nothing. It was brick dust. As far as the eye could see, was brick dust. It was insane. The smell of the explosions that had gone off, and the chaos of hearing the two guys that were injured screaming, and you couldn't see them or get to them, and bricks coming out of the sky for about, it must have seemed like about 5 minutes afterwards, these things have been blown so high. You know, the old ding, bang, ping, stuff coming out of the sky for ages. It was quite comedy. It was almost like being on the set of a Tom and Jerry film or something, you know, when something blows up and there's pots and pans falling all over the place. And I remember we reacted to this straight away, and we ran downtown and we tried to find the perpetrator. There was no chance. This bomb had been put in about 2 days ago before, and it was on a timer, so we weren't going to get them. But that was my first experience of the enemy in Ireland, which was, it was a bit of a wake-up call. We'd been there for a few months, not had anything happen. And you get a bit lax in your drills and stuff, but you know, straight after something like that, everybody's bang out of the gate again, everybody's on top of it, and your patrolling happens. And we went a bit hard on the town for a bit after that. But that was in 89. Quite incredible. The next few years, I spent nearly 5 years in Northern Ireland, in and out of there on different operations and stuff. I did Londonderry, I'd been to done some short tours in Belfast, I went to Omar, and in that time, you know, I saw a fair few incidents, although it wasn't as probably full on as, say, Iraq or Afghanistan or somewhere like that. You had to be careful. You couldn't take it for granted. It was very tense when you were actually working. You couldn't just take it for granted that you were going to get through to the end of the day, because it wasn't, you know. I think, as the IRA once said, you know, they've only got to be lucky once. We've got to be lucky all the time. And that was quite true. You know, you lived your life like that. You had to be lucky all the time, which was quite a stress on you if you were working a lot over there. But like I say, we got through those days. And like I say, compared with Afghanistan and Iraq, fairly similar. I mean, I've often been criticised for saying that as a terrorist organisation, the IRA actually weren't that good, which is, people would say, it's a bit harsh, Phil, or, you know, you're underestimating them. But I don't underestimate them. When I look at other terrorist organisations around the world, and I look at, you know, the Khmer Rouge, or I look at, you know, Al-Qaeda, or I look at, you know, some of the Islamic terrorist groups, you know, compared with the stuff that they're doing, yeah, the IRA were brutal. Yes, they came up with, there was a lot of bungled operations by them. You know, there was a lot of, it wasn't as hardcore, perhaps, as some people make it out to be. It certainly wasn't romantic, as I've seen people make it out. You know, they had their point, and I do get that. They had their point, but terrorism is never the answer for me, ever. And so, you know, if you're going to indulge in that, you know, expect the full might of the authorities to be coming down on you, because, you know, if you want to deal with terrorism, like I say, unfortunately, the world's had a great big dose of terrorism over the last few years, and it needs to be dealt with, as we've seen. So, you know, Irish terrorism is no exception. If you want to resort to terrorism, then, you know, there are plenty of good men who are prepared to don uniforms and deal with you, and that's the way it is. And I take my hat off and salute every last one of those men prepared to do violence on my behalf, or our behalf, as it were. That was my first early days. And it was from there, really, that I got my first exposure to Special Forces, because I started doing a job called Close Observation Platoon. Now, Close Observation Platoons worked covertly. We worked in observation towers, but we also worked on the ground in observation OPs. We used to go into bushes or derelicts and that sort of stuff, and we would take photographs of suspects and that sort of thing. And, you know, there was all sorts of different tasks for the close observation platoons, and they came under the bracket of, they weren't special forces, but they worked to the same desk as some of the spec ops stuff that was going on. So as a young man, it was a great thing to be involved with, and it was my first exposure of actually seeing the SAS in action. One of the courses that we had to do to become a member of the Close Observation Platoon meant that you had to, the instructors on there, there was always a Special Forces operator as an instructor on your course. So in terms of what I learned in those days on the Close Observation stuff, I learned loads. And like I say, my first exposure of seeing Special Forces, yes, I'd seen them in the jungles of Kenya on exercise, but I'd never seen them on operations proper. And although you weren't privy to everything you did come across them, you did, you know, see them now and again coming by. And it was something that I really aspired to do. We did some great jobs. I mean, we got into a couple of derelicts in the city and we took photographs of this player and that player. And it was a cracking job. And in between times, you'd be moving around in covert vehicles and dropping people off. And the work was specialist and took some great training, and you learned some awesome skills, you know, car drills and all that sort of stuff, should you get caught in illegal VCPs, vehicle checkpoints and that sort of thing. So it really was a cool job to do. And like I say, as a young man, it was my first exposure to doing something a little bit special, a little bit spec ops. For instance, in the early days, you were allowed to grow your hair long so that you blended in if you were in the cars and driving around. So it was, you know, you were different. You were doing something special. And I think it's important that young soldiers get exposure to other stuff up the ladder. Nowadays, you can, you know, as a British soldier, you can do SFG, Special Forces Support Group. You know, that's got a lot of lads are doing that getting some great exposure to seeing the way of the world with special operations and that sort of stuff. And it's a good foundation to get from something like that, from a Pathfinder platoon or SFFG, to then step up to Special Forces Selection proper. And like I say, in the UK, we have UKSF, which is our Tier 1 FS, is the SAS, and the SBS, who both do UKSF selection, a combined selection. And I know, you know, young lads ask me a lot now, you know, what's it like, Phil? I always tell them, you know, you've got to, if that's what you're inclining to do, if you're a young lad and you're wanting to go Special Forces, do it sooner rather than later, because you won't look back. You know, it's a great place to be. It really is. And I think if you talk to any spec ops operator, he'll tell you, you know, if that's what you really want to do, then get there sooner rather than later and grab onto it with both hands for the time that you're there, you know, and enjoy it moreover. You know, and I remember when I first got to Hereford, one of my sergeant majors said, you know, if you enjoy what you do, you don't work. And it was a very true thing of him to say. If you actually enjoy what you do, it's not work. So that was my early days. That was my first exposures as a young man to Special Forces and operations. It was all Northern Ireland in my early days. Like I say, I spent over 5 years on operations in Northern Ireland, which is, you know, not a massive amount of time, but it's still, you know, 5 years of your life spent on operations. It's a long time when you think about it. It's not the longest time, but it's still a long enough time. And then, like I say, after that, it was just things like Bosnia, Kosovo, and Sierra Leone, just little odds and sods, which we'll talk about another day, I'm sure. But there you go. I'm waffling on now about bits and pieces. So let's now talk about something else which is absolute passion to me, which is EDC. And I've been looking at these bracelets, okay, that have just been sort of like, they've been on the market for a long time. But there's some great of these paracorded bracelets on the market now, which is really cool. If you go on my Facebook page, I'm going to profile a few of them in the next few weeks, but there's some really cool stuff. And as a compliment to your EDC, when it comes to things like tourniquets or it comes to even splints and all that sort of stuff with the first aid side, a great length of paracord is a massive asset to you. So my EDC thing this week is these bracelets, and some of them have even got compasses and whistles, and I saw one the other day with a small blade on it as well, actually, which was quite cool. I don't think you managed to get that onto the planes, but yeah, the bracelets that we've been looking at for the EDC are really, really cool. So have a look at that. I'm sure at some stage Crate Club will bust out a paracord bracelet if they haven't done so already, and I haven't seen one yet, but I'm sure they will do, or at some stage one will come out. A great piece of kit. And like I say, the connotations of what you can do with that piece of kit, you know, even if you just strip it down as a spare bootlace one day, or tie your kit onto your back, or secure something to the top of your car, you can see where we're going with this, can't you? Having a great length of paracord on you is a massive bonus. And being able to keep it on your wrist, forget about it, it's there. Okay, so I've been wearing these bracelets now for the last couple of weeks to trial them out. And I'm having a good time with them. I think they're cool. They look all right. You can get them in various different colours. I've got them in black. I've got them in olive. I've got them in green. But that doesn't mean you have to have them in those colours. I mean, we're using this as a first aid piece of kit. I could have it in red. I could have it in yellow. I could have it in blue. In fact, I've got a yellow and blue one, because a lot of these guys now are doing regimental colours with them as well. So the point being, and I'll stress this again, the point being that we have a large amount of paracord on my person at any one time, which I can do hundreds and hundreds of cool things with. I mean, this is extreme, but with the belts that I wear, the 511 belts with the loops on the front of them, I can even prussic. So I can strip this down, I can make what's called a prussic, and I can climb rope. So I can climb rope, I can climb poles. I can make the connotations with this. And I think as we get into these bracelets, I think I'm going to actually showcase some of this stuff on my live show of what we can do when we strip these bracelets down and how we can get this stuff out and going. That's going to be really cool. So look forward to that on Soft Rep, because that will be something to look forward to. It'll be really cool. EDC with myself, showing you some of the cool tricks you can do with really inexpensive kit that doesn't cost a lot at all. These bracelets, I mean, geez, if you pay more than $2 or $3 for them, you'd be paying too much. You really would. And of course, if you got really cute, I know some guys that tie their own and make their own out of these. So it's only a series of retaining type knots, which are quite cool when they look. You know, seriously, have a look at them. Have a look at the paracord bracelets. They're a great bit of kit. We've covered EDC, we've looked at me and Northern Ireland, and we've talked remembrance. which is always, always close to my heart. Let's see if I can play you the last post. The last post is always played on Remembrance Day. That's what starts our 2 minute silence, is always done. This was filmed by the Cliffs of Dover. There we go. Don't forget to check things out on Crate Club and to check everything out on softrep.com. Hopefully next time without a sore throat, as you can tell I've got today, I shall see you all very soon, where I shall cover some more topics for you. Until then, OJ's wins as always, and I'll see you all later.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.